Ah, thanks for having me, Wolfgang.
How do I introduce you? You're a strength and conditioning coach in the tactical field, working for the U.S. Army.
That's awesome. That's about right.
Yeah, that's the most detailed I can go.
Yeah, that'll be just fine. Hell yeah.
So you've actually been stationed here in Stuttgart for quite some time now.
Yeah.
What is it, a year?
Yeah, for 1 year. For 1 year I've been here, and prior to being here, I was in the U.K., also working at a unit there, a special forces unit in the U.K., and before that, I was in the U.S. Story goes on.
Yeah. We actually met April 2010 in Rhode Island at the Alico Strength Summit. Remember, it was I think that was the first one they ever held, and it was a 1 day event.
Like
4 or 5 lectures.
Yep. Was it 1 day or 2 day?
I think the first one was 1 day.
Okay.
And then the ones after.
Yeah.
There was a 2 days where there was multiple speakers on the first day, and there was always one speaker on the second day. I think the second one was. The second one was Al Vermeil,
okay.
The guy that won a championship ring with the Chicago Bulls in the 90s.
Legend.
And NFL, San Francisco 49ers in the 80s.
Yeah.
The only guy who won championship rings in the NFL and the NBA.
Yeah.
And the one after that was Ivan Abagiev, the former Bulgarian head coach in weightlifting.
Yeah.
And the one after that was Yves Nadeau. And I think that was it. The first one was pretty legendary, though. It was Ed Cohen was there.
Yeah.
Hugo Girard, the Canadian strongman, was there.
Yeah, I did his deadlift workshop. Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
From Ed Cohen?
No, from...
Hugo Girard.
Yeah, from Girard. Yeah, I think I have a photo of it, too. It's pretty awesome. Awesome stuff. Never forgot it. At that conference.
The
practical. Yeah, the practical section.
I remember. Yeah. Where... So you were the guy that demonstrated the deadlift.
Yeah, that was me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I remember that during the practical, Ed Cohen, Hugo Girard lied down on the bench and did bench press, and Ed Cohen was actually correcting him.
Yeah.
Which was pretty...
That's
pretty
right.
Cool picture.
Yeah.
Big ass. Like, Hugo Girard competed at World's Strongest Man. It's like 145 kilos.
Yeah.
And then Ed Cohen is a fairly small fellow.
Yeah,
like 99 kilos.
Yeah,
but super strong. And they're like, he was giving him pointers on the bench press. And I think Hugo Girard's best bench press in a t-shirt is like 315 kilos.
Yeah, so, stupid.
Fairly strong guy.
Yeah, I didn't remember that moment until you said it, but it was something profound and beautiful about that. And you know, I think he talked about never being above taking coaching and critiquing. And he said, you know. And he pointed at Ed Cohen, and he talked about what a legend he was and what an honor it was for him to teach him and talk to him, you know? Ah, man, it's so cool. It's funny how, like, moments that you have lived that you forgot, that, you know, somebody else was there to see it, and they'll remind you of that lesson. And that was an important one from that day, for sure.
I haven't thought about that one, the first one, till, like, a couple days ago. I thought, like, hey, the first time we met was a long time ago, because your friend Brendan Horrigan was speaking at the same conference. It was, I think it was a lecture on strength and conditioning for football, American football.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's I was flipping his slides. Brendan Horrigan was, I mean, he still is my mentor, a great human being, a great coach. He gave me my first shot at coaching, and I got to tag along with him and flip slides. And get to be at this conference, you know. So it's just incredible serendipity that we're here today, and we have these people in common, and yeah, just wonderful.
What university was that back then?
It was University of Virginia.
Okay, because you're originally from Virginia, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, from grew up in originally. Actually, I'm half Nigerian, half American. So my younger years were spent in Lagos.
Okay.
Yeah, Lagos, Nigeria. And then my family moved to Virginia. Yeah.
You were born in Lagos?
Yeah. Well, born in Virginia. It's a bit of a story. Okay. Born in Virginia, but as soon as I was born, my family went back to Lagos. So my earliest memories are all there until I was about 10 years old. And then we moved back to the U.S. and we settled in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's where the University of Virginia is. And
how's Lagos? Because it's known to be a bit of a rough city, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it can be absolutely rough and hard and full of sharks, absolutely. But also incredibly beautiful and kind and full of life and vibrant.
How many people live there? How big is it?
Oh, I mean, it's one of the biggest cities in Africa. I'm not sure about how many million people live there, but one of the most densely populated and definitely one of the highest populations. So it's jam-packed. Jam-packed with people, with cars, with traffic, with everything.
It's a funny statistic about Africa I read a while ago, which is 1 out of 5 Africans is Nigerian.
Yes, absolutely. You'll find
how small Nigeria is geographically.
In the diaspora, 100%, all over. Yeah, all over the globe. And historically, as well as just in these contemporary times, yeah, Nigerians are everywhere. A funny thing about Nigeria is actually the first place I saw someone lifting with weights.
Oh, and was that? You remember?
Yeah, I remember the day clearly. I was, I think I was probably like 6 or 7 years old, maybe like 7 years old. And my father had just gotten sick. He was, he ended up passing away not too long after this memory. But he was in a hospital, and as things are in Lagos then, and even now, you can have, you know, a giant high rise, and not too far away from it could be like a slum, open sewer, corrugated shacks, people living in abject poverty, right? And I looked outside of his hotel window, and there was a neighborhood across the street that looked just like that, open sewer, corrugated shacks, people cooking outside, no running sewage, you know, poverty. But in the front, there were a couple lads lifting a steel pipe with some concrete cinder blocks on the end, and they're bench pressing this cinder block. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. So immediately I went back home, found a broomstick and some cinder blocks in the yard, and that was my first weight set. And that started the obsession with weight training. Yeah.
You started fairly young.
Yeah, right? Been a strength coach since I was 7. Yeah, come for me. Oh, man.
So what's the first time you went to a gym, remember? A real gym?
A real gym? I started like, in the U.S. Yeah, I was younger than high school. In the U.S., like, I got to the U.S. and I started, like, watching these shows on Saturday mornings. It was like bodybuilding shows, and they talk about like supersetting. There was a couple different variations of them. There's one that was kind of like cheesy, and it had like a bunch of like aerobics in there, and then there was like a no shit like bodybuilding. And I was like, again, I was still obsessed, but no access to a weight room until I was probably like 14. I used to sneak in the health club. My mom would go to, she would let me do it, but if they caught me, they'd like kick me out. But I would always just be trying to get in the back door, work out until someone's like, hey, kid, you're not 16. Get out of here. Which is complete bogus, right? Like, anyway, liabilities, insurance. I get it. But anyway.
The first gym I visited in the U.S., the first PT gym I visited in the U.S., I asked the guy, like, what do you do for checkup and so on? And he showed me all these sheets, and it was like, 6 sheets written on both sides just for liability waivers. Mm-hmm. I went through and I was like, he was like, that's the US. Like, it was basically 12 pages of just liability. You need to put your initials here, put your initials here, sign here.
Nobody wants to take responsibility.
Some funny lawsuits. Like, the classic one is the one where a lady tried to dry her cat in the microwave.
Oh.
Never heard of that?
No.
Since then, actually, the manual for a microwave says that you cannot dry pets in it.
Oh, no.
Because obviously the cat didn't survive.
Yeah.
She sued the microwave company.
That's insane.
And she won.
That's insane.
I think there's a lot of these lawsuits in the U.S. Yeah. So you think like...
Yeah, how does that happen?
Yeah,
well, I thought you were gonna go for the McDonald's coffee that's too hot.
No, I didn't.
Some lady burnt her mouth or something. The coffee was too hot.
And then she sued McDonald's.
Sued them, and won.
And won.
Yeah. Crazy. Hey man, yeah, I don't know. I don't like that rhythm so much. You know what I mean? Yeah. So.
So you started working. Your first job. Was it
the
University of Virginia?
Well, that was my first, like, full-time. No, that's not correct. My first full-time coaching job was at Amherst College in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yeah. And prior to that, I had interned
That's a bit of a drive from Virginia.
Yeah, it was a haul. It's actually where I went to school too as well. So for college, I ended up going to school there. It's a beautiful school, great educators, great professors, great friends there. And a really marvelous opportunity to get to leave, you know, the Mid-Atlantic Virginia area and go to New England to this prestigious school. And I don't know, get to go to school there and then eventually coach there. And that was sort of my first break. I was strength coached for all sports, for everything. Yeah, every sport they had there, I was interacting with.
What was the most popular at that school?
Popular sports, basketball. Basketball, football, soccer. Yeah. But the basketball team, I mean, they won a national championship. So I got a national championship ring with the lads on that team. Yeah. I mean, what's superb. The Amherst College, Lord Jeffs. Okay. Lord Jeffs, for short for Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who was
the name Amherst before.
Yeah. So he was the, obviously he started the school, but he was also, he's known for being the originator of like chemical warfare.
Okay.
He handed out blankets of smallpox to Native Americans. Yeah. He didn't himself hand them out, but he kind of gave the order that this would be an okay thing to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Solution.
A good, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy,
isn't it?
Didn't know.
Yeah, it's a bit nutty. So anyway, interesting that we said that, because as things go and as time like progresses, people think more carefully about things. So even the name Lord Jeffrey, you know, celebrating it in that way, the kids, or not the kids, but the young folks at that school ended up changing the mascot, so they're no longer the Lord Jeffs. And they're now the Mammoths is their new school mascot.
Why?
Because of that history, that legacy, that history there. People, yeah, it's problematic. I think
how many student athletes were there?
No, not a big school at all. I think total number of students there, maybe like 5,000 students. Okay. 5,000, 6,000 students, maybe.
How many are athletes?
Athletes, like 1,200.
Okay, yeah. That's a fairly big chunk.
Yeah.
That's crazy. College sport, if you've never been into the US in a college and seen the college sport.
Yeah.
The first time I've got an insight was was May 2010, briefly after we met for the first time.
Okay.
I visited Preston Green in the University of Clemson. So also at the same conference as we met the first time, I met Preston the first time.
Oh, that was the first time you met Preston?
First time I met him in person.
Okay, wow.
Before,
okay.
But the first time we met in person.
Cool.
And briefly after, I visited him in South Carolina, is it right? Clemson.
Yeah.
And that was quite, so just the professionality, our professionalism.
Yeah.
Of how the whole thing is set up, the facilities, the coaching staff. Like, I always like to compare it with European soccer. European soccer is more amateur.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
American college sports.
Yeah.
Like, and they all have their own weight room.
Yeah.
Clemson had like the football weight room.
Yeah.
It was 40 people training at the same time.
Yeah, it's
the
stupid.
Team was like, American football team was 100 to 110 people.
Yeah.
And you're training in shifts.
Yeah.
Of three.
Yeah.
And the stadium was over 90,000 seats, and it was sold out every single game.
Yeah.
I actually went to a fairly important baseball game. Don't remember what it exactly was, but it was fairly important. It was sold out. We got, thanks to Preston, we got seats like one row behind the guy that catches the ball.
Yeah.
The batter.
The catcher and the batter, catcher. Yeah.
Right
on the home plate. Yeah.
And it's
a great spot.
Quite exciting baseball game. So it was the first time I saw a baseball game live. It was quite exciting. And then they had to play a second game the next day, and we watched it on TV. And it was so boring on TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then just the facilities and the level of professionalism, you know, like stuff like in Florida, where he's now a strength conditioning coach for basketball.
Right.
Like they fly to the games in a private jet.
Yeah.
Like that's.
Yeah, police escort, the whole nine. Yeah, steak dinners. Yeah.
And American football is even bigger
Yeah.
than basketball.
Yeah.
When you were at the University of Virginia, you did all sports too, or just?
Just football there.
Okay, there it was just, so it was a football school.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. It's a football, basketball, lacrosse, soccer school.
Okay.
Yeah, it was interesting. Interesting dynamic, you know, sort of like competing goals. No, not really certain, you know, schools that throw everything behind it, like Clemson, like they want to do it all. They want to do it big. And like you're describing the facilities, I'm like, yeah, I remember visiting, and yeah, it's a factory, but and it's like pristine, and it's built, it's custom built, and there is no expense that's spared, and there's no limit. There's no limit to the imagination in terms of how they can accommodate for the program, you know, this big behemoth of a program. And then even like, man, going to be like playing against Clemson, like if you're on that field, like that's an experience I'll never forget. I mean, literally the whole stadium is vibrating. The ground is shaking. It's insane. It's intense.
94,000. I remember at the end of the stadium, there's grass hill.
Yeah.
Actually, when the players, I was like, why is there a grass hill?
Yeah.
Because that's where they make entrance.
Yeah.
So they actually go from the lockers into a bus. The bus takes them around the stadium. And then basically at the top of the stadium, the bus lets them out. And they run down that grass hill into the stadium, onto the field with like 90,000+ people cheering.
Some old Art of War type stuff, you know. Charge downhill, not uphill.
Unfortunately, that was at that time I was there. There was no game on. It was just baseball on.
Mm-hmm.
It was inside the stadium on the field. That was the biggest stadium I've ever been inside. Like, there's soccer stadiums that big. There's very few out there.
Yeah.
Germany, there's a few big ones. Stuttgart is one of the biggest, and it's like 64,000, I think. So it's fairly small compared to 90,000+.
Yeah, you could say.
And everyone, like, in the town, like all the intersections, there were like big tiger ponds on the street, and waiters would wear Clemson gear.
Yeah.
And then one day, the first day I went to the baseball game, I went for lunch, and like the waiters started asking me about the game. Like, just be like, the main topic that day was college baseball.
Yeah. Yeah, super, super cool.
Even ESPN has their own TV channel.
Yeah, just for college.
Just for college sports.
Yeah.
How long were you in Virginia?
I was there for, I guess, 3 years. Yeah. I started there as a volunteer coach and then became a graduate assistant. So they're paying for me to go to school. And then I got a full-time job. Over that course of time, I worked for two different strength coaches. The last of the coaches I worked for was Brandon. But yeah.
And Brandon then got a job as a head strength conditioning coach in Bowling Green, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then you went with him.
Yeah. So then I packed up and headed up to Ohio to go work with him there. And that was an awesome experience. I mean, the location we're at is Bowling Green, Ohio. So it's not, there isn't a whole lot going on there other than the university, right? And literally there's just a lot of fields. Like you'll be driving down green, open fields, and then boom, there's a stadium, and now you're at Bowling Green University. And there's nothing around. And like half the time, if the wind blows, it smells like manure and like pig farm, you know what I mean? Like,
crazy.
Oh yeah, it was in the middle of the sticks.
But before we started the recording, we were talking about Texas and hunting.
Yeah.
And you have brown bears in Virginia.
Yeah.
I was quite surprised. There must be quite a bit of a rural land.
Oh, brown bears. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We got a lot of rural land, Blue Ridge Mountains, Blue Ridge Parkway.
Ohio must be good hunting too, right? With so much greenery.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. But I don't know. I wasn't even paying attention to any of that. Like I was pretty much there, like on tunnel vision, like legit. Yeah, just working, not making no money, making a little bit of money, just enough money to make it. You know, sharing a small apartment with two or three other coaches. One's at Fordham University now. Another one's at works for the Bills. And I mean, we shared like a tiny apartment, the three of us, and we just basically were like, we're here to work football, and that's what we did. And yeah, it was awesome though. So much fun. The kids were like we had the particular type of kid we had was usually had like a bit of a chip on their shoulder. You know, they got overlooked by the Michigans or like the bigger programs. And but it's not for lack of talent. You know, maybe they were on a team, they didn't win a lot of games, so they don't have a lot of tape or, you know, whatever. They missed the game. Whatever, you never know the rhyme and reason of these things. But we had a team full of these kids that were just like, just wanted to like play ball. They love ball. They wanted to work hard. And that experience was awesome because we got to see kids just become freakishly strong. So it was, for me, it was a wonderful experience to get to see Brandon use his skill and have a group of kids really take to it and then see them achieve like freakishly impressive numbers in the weight room.
What's the most freakish thing you've ever seen in the weight room?
I mean, man, like, I mean, we had quite a number of guys that were squatting over 600, you know, for reps. And not all of them
over 260 kilos.
Yeah.
For reps.
For reps.
And college like, is like 18 to 22 year olds.
Yep. Yeah. And not, and it wasn't like one guy. It was like, I don't know, like six or seven guys. And not all of them were like big, you know what I mean? Like a couple of them were like running backs, you know, like 100 and I don't know, like 185, 190 pounds.
What?
Squatting six bills. Yeah.
That's like 70 something kilos.
Stupid. 70 I was honestly, 260. Yeah. I was honestly like scared. I won't like, I'm not afraid to admit it. Like I was afraid. I was like, this can't be real, what I'm seeing. But yeah, it's for real. Power cleans, 400 pound power cleans.
It's 180
kilo pound. Legit power cleans, you know, like five, six guys doing that, you know? Yeah, freaking. And it was to the point where, you know, and I'd never been a part of this discussion. How strong do our guys need to be? We don't need them to be any stronger. Like no one ever talks about it. Everyone's always like, man, we got to chase more numbers. We got to get stronger. We got stronger. No one's ever like, nah, we're strong enough. And I got to see that. And it was wonderful.
That's that body weight and that strong, he is fast.
He's fast. He had a twin sister. A twin sister was on the track team. She's bigger than he is. She obviously now she can't lift what he could lift. Yeah, obviously.
She'll put 500 pounds.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, man. I mean, it was completely interesting because she obviously there was like no chance. She was smoking everybody.
What discipline did she do in track?
She was a 100 meter sprinter. Oh, okay. She ran 100. She ran 2. She ran the 4. Yeah, she was on a relay team as well. Yeah, all the short distances. Everything under 400. Yeah.
She was press.
She could press. She could press. She could pull.
And the guys on the metal, what's the most freakish thing you've ever seen in the bench press?
Oh, the bench press. Ah, man. There was a kid named Dulce that was at Virginia. And I think his bench press was always really impressive, you know, to me. And I mean, he was just barrel chested. And I can't remember what his numbers were. But it, I mean, he would rep 405 for like, definitely more like 10 reps of 405
kilos.
Yeah.
How big was he?
He wasn't like super, he wasn't huge. He was maybe like 200 and I'll give him like 240 pounds. 240 pounds, right around there.
108 kilos, 109 kilos.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, he was built, well built kid. Yeah.
That's crazy. Especially in Germany, since we do not have the strength training culture,
yeah.
Which in the U.S., if you play American football, what age do you start lifting?
Oh, I mean, it could be early. Like, yeah.
14, 15, 16.
Definitely by 14, yeah.
So you have guys
and you're around it
lifting throughout puberty.
Yeah.
And then they're in college, 19, 20.
Yeah.
And they have just been lifting for 5 years.
Yeah, some guys powerlifting since high school, you know? And so, like, those kids, they have been, like, you know, drilled, great technique.
If you bench over 20 pounds, mm-hmm. 100 kilos,
yeah,
you're in the top 1% in any German gym.
There's yeah.
very few gyms in Germany where you're not in the top 1%.
Yeah.
If you're benching above 100 kilos. Whereas,
yeah.
if you go to a college weight room, benching 100 kilos,
it's a warm-up. It's a warm-up. Is that why folks are looking at me funny when I'm in here lifting? Like, I'm around here lifting in the way in the rooms, and I'm like, wow, folks, I feel like people are looking at me lift. I'm like, yeah, nah, this is what I'm lifting is nothing special. Yeah.
They do this 220-pound bench press rep test at the NFL Combine, right?
Right.
What's the, you know what the record is? Something like 50 reps or so?
Something like that. Yeah.
100 kilos for 50 reps.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. If it is, I think it's, but I think it's more like 35 reps or something like that. Something like that. 35 reps maybe.
You need to look that up.
Yeah, I think it's in the 30s. Dulce wasn't too far off from that. I think he was benching to 225 for like 28 reps. Yeah.
That's pretty strong.
Yeah, he's a strong kid.
Not bad. Had this guy that did a few seminars with me, and he's in the Midwest, and he has a gym, and he is getting a lot of guys in college football players, and he told me about the Samoan guy that came.
Yeah.
18-year-old Samoan guy.
Yeah.
Bench pressed 500 pounds.
Yeah.
On his first day in the gym.
I believe
obviously
it.
Samoan kid, he was a big kid.
Yeah.
But basically never lifted and bench pressed 500 pounds, about 220 kilos, 4-0-1-0 tempo.
Yeah.
His first day in the gym.
4-0 tempo.
There's a statistic
that
if you're born in the US, your mom's Samoan, your dad's Samoan.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a 50% chance you play in the NFL.
That's hilarious. that's pretty good.
Those guys are built. I was in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and that was those Polynesian guys.
Like, yeah.
They have the thickest wrists, the thickest ankles, and they're just big people.
Yeah.
And the strength. The University of Hawaii is one of the best American football universities, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I believe that. And then also the strength culture there too, strength training. Right, Bill Starr, he was out there.
Oh, yeah, he was?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, Bill Starr is at the University of Hawaii.
Was he a strength coach there?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. If I remember correctly. So along my travels there, I ran into... And I actually interned for a coach. His name's Augie Morelli. He's at the University of Delaware now, but at the time he was at Georgetown University. So I spent a summer working there, and that was one of the books he gave me was Bill Starr, The Strongest Shall Survive. And that was, you know, like one of the first books on strength training that I really got into. Yeah. And definitely in there, I think Bill Starr is talking about being in Hawaii. I think, if I remember correctly, there's some photos of guys like squatting in flip-flops, doing lifts in flip-flops. And as much you want to like laugh at it, these guys were yoked up and they were moving like big weight. And it's kind of like, that's kind of interesting. Like, who does that? But okay, you know.
In the 80s and 90s, they always had the Hawaiian record breaker.
Yeah.
Which was one of the biggest powerlifting, was one of the most important powerlifting competitions in the world, and was a Hawaiian record breaker in Honolulu.
Mm.
Ed Cohen competed there multiple times. When I was in Hawaii, Ed was there too.
Yeah.
And some of his powerlifting buddies would show up for dinner
the
first night, and they were basically telling stories from back then. I mean, he would compete and then get out to Hawaii for a couple of days and then squat 1,000 pounds.
Yeah.
And basically, that was one of the main competitions.
Ah, that's really interesting. So when were you in Hawaii?
I think it was January 2015.
Okay.
It's quite a bit. It was University of Hawaii. They had a conference.
Yeah.
It was a multi-day conference. And that's what I was there for.
Oh, that's cool. Did you do any other stops or you just went straight to Hawaii?
Yeah, I went, because it was a pretty long way. Going from Germany to Hawaii.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I went... I like to fly Air France.
Yeah.
So I went to Paris. I went from Paris to LA, and I was like, shortly before that, I was in LA and trained at Gold's Venice, and I was like, let's do 2 days or 3 days, I think it was in LA.
Yeah.
So I just got a hotel at Venice Beach.
Yeah.
And I was training twice a day at Gold's Venice.
Cool.
I think it was for 3 days, and then I did the 4 hour something flight over to Hawaii, and then the conference was like. I think that was the first day was just like dinner and like little activities. And then it was 3 days conference. And then I went to the North Shore and we did a little, went out with a boat and saw humpback whales.
Okay.
And did a little snorkel. Soho was good. Humpback Whales was crazy.
Huge. They're huge.
North Coast with like these crazy waves.
Yeah.
And then I went to Dominican Republic to teach another seminar.
Okay. How legit.
That was the end of January, beginning of February. It was actually the first seminar ever taught in the DR.
And that was with JC?
JC's old gym.
Okay.
It was a pretty good, a pretty diverse group. We had like 12, 13 people from the US. We had a handful from Europe. And then we had like the OG Dominicans, 10 of them or so.
Yeah.
That was a pretty fun group. I think it was seminar, it was 3 or 4 days. And actually the last day, instead of finishing early, we started late.
Okay.
So everybody could go to the beach on Sunday morning. So we drive out 40 minutes out to the beach, go for a swim, have breakfast, and then drive back in and then start teaching.
Oh, that's amazing.
That was because there's no traffic on Sunday morning, so it's only 40 minutes to the first nice beach.
Yeah.
Plus, there's Sunday morning fairly early, there's nobody on the beach, so basically it's crystal clear water. We sat out on this pier with the restaurant. We had some ceviche, some grilled fish.
Yeah.
Take a swim in between, and then go back and have the seminar. There's very few places where you can do that.
Yeah, that's just beautiful.
I taught in Thailand last year. It was like a 7-day camp. I was there for 3.5 days. And there was the morning lectures. There was a breakfast room right on the beach.
Okay.
And on the terrace of the breakfast room, there was the morning lectures. So basically, there was like 2 meters and there was the water. In the afternoon, it was a bit more inside, like a little jungle-y look. But basically, you could go into the water between lectures.
Yeah.
That's a setting. It's
I can't beat that.
It's quite special. There's very few places that actually allow you to do that.
Yeah.
Where you can have a gym, a lecture room, so close to the water. Even in Dominican, Santo Domingo, despite being on the water, they don't have their own beaches.
Yeah.
Have you been to Dominican?
Yeah. I've been to, Punta Cana.
Been there once too. We drove out there.
Yeah.
The North Coast, if you ever go back to the Dominican, there's no airport there's no big airport on the North Coast. They have the airport in Santo Domingo in the south, and then they have Punta Cana Airport, which is the east.
Right.
But in north, there's Puerto Plata, but it's fairly far the west of in the northwest. Yet if you go in the northeast, there's Samaná, which is a peninsula.
Yeah.
And the north part of Samaná is Las Terrenas.
Okay.
Which is like, this is how you think of Caribbean.
Yeah.
Because if you're in Punta Cana, it's fairly busy.
Yeah.
It's Caribbean, but it's fairly busy. Whereas if you go to Las Terrenas, resorts. It's like hotels with 10 rooms.
Yeah.
And there's like the restaurants don't have actual menus. They have like this board. And they basically in the morning, they write on the board what is there today. So the one day you get mahi-mahi, the next day you get dorado, different type of fish.
Yeah, that's the way to live, for sure.
And then you're like, it's beautiful water.
Yeah,
it's always good weather. Even when it rains, an hour later it's Caribbean weather.
Yeah, I was actually supposed to go to the DR this year, and was it in March? It's like right when Corona happened.
To do what?
I was going to an Afro Beats festival.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm big in it was in Punta Cana.
Cool.
Yeah, so imagine like me and like, I don't know, 4 of my best friends. We all like Afro beats. We all like similar music. Yeah. We went to one festival in Portugal maybe 6 months prior. It was amazing. We're going on to the follow-on. Everyone's geared up. Everyone's ready to go. 2 of the friends get there. Corona strikes. End of problems. Yeah, barely.
A friend of mine, he was supposed to stay in the DR for 2 months. Went there in February. Because I taught a camp there in February, and he was supposed to stay there for 2 months and then continue his travel to the US.
Yeah.
He stayed there for 4 months.
Yeah.
Or 5 months. I think he left somewhere like June, July.
Yeah.
He was stuck in Las Terrenas.
Yeah.
Because he was there only for a week. And then during that week, they did the lockdown, and in DR, you could not travel between states.
Yeah.
So he was basically stuck on the north coast of the DR. And there was like, back then they had a lockdown, so no, You are not supposed to be out after 5.
After 5?
After 5 p.m.
Oh, man.
And if you go to the beach, yeah. you can only walk or go in the water. Yeah. You cannot lie on the beach. And they were pretty much enforcing that too. So they were fairly strict. I think he was stuck a month on the North Shore. And then he was stuck another, whatever, 4 to 6 weeks in Santo Domingo before there was an actual flight back to the UK.
Wow.
But then there's worse places to be
stuck. Yeah, that's the question is like, did he, like in his like retrospect, is he like happy that he got stuck there? Probably better to get stuck there than the UK.
Yeah, that's probably. I think it's very.
As long as you don't get sick.
Places where it would be better to be stuck.
Yeah.
Than in the North Shore of the Dominican.
Yeah.
But what do? You know, you read, you cook, you have great food.
Yeah.
You have the best weather. You can go to the beach every day.
Yeah, all the same stuff you're gonna have to do at home, but with minus the crummy weather.
Much nicer surrounding.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, how the surrounding can influence like your overall outlook, you know? Yeah.
So. That's pretty, yeah. It says the Dominican is a place I like quite a bit. It's great people, great food. The gym JC has is outstanding.
Yeah, and the
good selection of equipment.
Yeah.
Great atmosphere. It's always a fun one.
Yeah, and that you could, you know, go to the beach before the seminar. Like, that's completely the opposite of what that first seminar experience was that we had. Because the one thing that always stuck with me was Poliquin at the end of our conference turning out the lights while everyone is still in the room. You know what I mean? And, you know, yeah,
just,
so...
Just so you know you're supposed yeah. to leave now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what blew my mind, you know? Because, okay, I didn't have to pay, right? The coach I'm working with is doing the presentation, so this is a free ride for me, right? I did have to travel pretty far, but I didn't cross seas. I didn't come from Australia. I didn't come from Sweden, Germany, you know, all these places. And folks at the end of a conference doing what they usually do, which is like talk and discuss and network and yeah. Soon as the last presentation was done, Poliquin was at that light switch, turned it off, and told everyone to go home. I thought that was hilarious, you know?
I'm hungry. I need to go to a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, now. We're going to eat now. Everybody out. Oh, man.
I didn't even remember that.
Yeah.
I remember training in the middle of the conference. There was one lecture on some, like, aerobic training, heart rate variability.
Mm-hmm.
That was...
I remember that. Yeah.
I think this was second to last or so.
Yeah.
Hugo Girard did a talk. Ed Cohen did a talk. Brandon did a talk. The legendary Cal Dietz.
Yeah, that's Cal Dietz. Yes.
That's the first time I met Cal Dietz.
Oh, man. I remember. I forgot who was there. Yeah.
I get asked about triphasic training regularly.
Yeah.
And back then, he was talking about triphasic training.
Yeah, man. He was killing
it. Everybody was like, fuck, like... He just came out with something.
Yeah. Like, they thought it was... Like, nah, man.
And now it's like, here's a book.
You know, yeah.
Like, triphasic training, I get asked about it regularly.
Yeah, well, like, it's a staple in everyone's stuff.
How did that happen?
Yeah. Like,
just
commonplace just equipment companies are now like the triphasic training arms on squat racks, you know, for the contrast training, French contrast, yeah. The band-assisted
yeah.
plyos. You know, that's Cal Dietz. I don't know anyone else who was really doing that before. Like,
I mean, other people were, but
yeah.
And he's like sending out his job offers.
Yeah.
Have you been on his newsletter?
No.
He would send out every couple of weeks. I would get a list.
Yeah.
Of like 50 job offers.
Really?
All over the U.S. for some strength coach positions. Like, he would curate these job offers and
yeah.
send out to everyone in his list.
Man, what a legend.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he's awesome. Guy. He's a crazy guy. And just, I mean, he's you know, he's one of those type of guys that maybe want to be a strength coach, you know, like really loves his craft, is genuine, is kind, is patient, isn't he's not afraid. And I went, not maybe it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I did a short stint in at a Exos facility in the Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis, downtown Minneapolis.
You worked for Exos quite some time, right?
Yeah, on and off for yeah, I don't know, maybe until like you, 7 or 8 years.
You came with me 6 or 7 years ago or so,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know, I didn't realize how big Exos was.
Yeah.
Back then it was like they had 100 coaches in sports,
yeah,
but 200 in tactical.
Yeah, yeah.
So like 66% roughly of their staff was actually working with Army, Navy, Air Force, and so on.
Yeah, that happened really quickly too. I mean, the first time I was working at Athletes Performance, or it was Athletes Performance Exos, there was like 6 coaches, and then 10, then 100, then military contracts, and they definitely exploded, you know.
How was that Mayo Clinic stint?
Oh, it was cool. I mean, you know, I didn't really work with a lot of athletes there. It was very corporate, you know, so I think I was training some businessmen, a couple of kids, but no really athletes. Yeah, not even patients. These are just people that are paying the big price tag to train at the Mayo Clinic in downtown Minneapolis. Yeah, it was interesting, you know. Yeah, and I think it was really about, maybe it was a lull in the season. They had one professional athlete. He was a professional like snowboarder that was there at the time, but also great coaches there. Another guy, Adam Morande, I spent a lot of time to talk to him, talk shop with him. He's a pretty brilliant guy. But yeah, at least over that time, I got a chance to go visit Cal Dietz and sit in his office. And
he's in Minneapolis too.
He's in Minneapolis, yeah. So I mean, that's part of the deal too. You know, that's something I got from Brandon is, when you travel, you got to look up and see who's around and go visit them in their place, you know. That's why I came, saw you out. It's like, go see the coach, go see his gym, go talk to him in his shop, and go learn, you know. So, sought out Cal Dietz, hit him up. He said, sure, come by. And, I mean, it was wonderful. You know, I walk in the weight room, and he's got his graduate assistants who are there. And when I say, hey, I'm here to see Coach Dietz, you know, you can see on their faces like the admiration they got for him, you know. And it was so genuine, and it was just awesome to see them like excited to be in their training, to be learning, and, you know, to be associated with him. So they took me through their weight room, took me to his office, sit in his office, and it's like, man, stacks of paper everywhere. I was like, yo, this guy is a mad scientist. He really is, you know.
I remember he loved the Russian sports scientists.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Quoting them.
He's got all their the translated manuscript. They were all over the place. And I was like, shit, I will never feel bad about having a lot of shit in my office. Because if Dietz is doing it like this, nobody can talk shit about my desk being messy. All right. I don't want to hear nothing about it. This is just me being an inner genius, okay? This messy desk that I got. So, but yeah, man, I mean, it was just, I don't know.
Was that your first spot when you worked with Exos?
No, I did a lot of interesting projects with them. First,
which one do you like best?
Oh, man. Geez, all of them were pretty interesting. I mean, the very first one I did was, I've worked with one of the top units that you can work with. And it was sort of in the early days, I guess you would call it, of strength coaches working with the military. And that to me was completely interesting. I'd never been on a military base before, and they didn't really tell me much about what I was doing. They just said, hey, you're going to be at this location for 2 weeks and you're training these guys. And that's all the information you need to know. I said, cool, sounds good. I'm just happy to help, you know. And then we get to the base and we go through a gate. I'm like, okay, I'm on a military base. Then we go through another gate. I'm like, wow, it's a lot of gates. We go through another gate. And I'm like, man, this is like what the fuck am I doing? This is the most secure. It doesn't get any more secure than this. And, you know, after the fact, then I realized like the level that I was at. It's basically like taking, I don't know, you're a high school strength coach and you all of a sudden you're on the Patriots team and you're in the Super Bowl. That's like the level that I just jumped. Not even a high school coach. I'll say like a middle school strength coach. And you're used to like training kids like for their basic PE tests. And then you get bounced to the pros. And like that's the kind of jump that I went through. Yeah, so that was probably my most.
What type of training did you do with those guys?
It was really, at the time, you know, it was really just a lot of mobility stuff. It was following the Exos, like their paradigm, their training methodology, you know, which was, the movement prep, the pillar prep, the glute activation, you know, the push, the pulls, like really, really basic foundational stuff.
Did you lift weights
with them? We did a little bit of weightlifting, but not a whole lot. Yeah, it was really straightforward, just really simple. Just move them, learn how to like march, learn how to march, learn how sprint mechanics, acceleration, deceleration, change the direction. Those were the bigger things that we spent more time doing. And then, and just learning, you know, I think that was the biggest thing I liked doing too, was just hearing stories and seeing what guys do. You know, they had this one conditioning test that I really liked was, there's a wall, it's maybe like a 4-foot wall, not really high, but they would have you basically scale the wall, jump over it, and then land in a push-up position on one side, and then scale it, land in a push-up position on the other side, and they did that back and forth for like 5 minutes. And it's like, yes,
it sounds like,
see how many reps you can get.
Burpees 2.0.
Yeah, it's insane. It's gross. It's gross. And then I was like, huh, this is interesting. This is what you guys do for conditioning, huh? They're like, yep, this is what we do. I was like, yeah, that's pretty gross. I mean, I did it and it was miserable, but it was, you know, those are the things that stuck out to me. Another event was, some of the obstacle courses. So one of them is called a slide for life. It's a rope that's suspended at two different heights. So it kind of comes down at a downward angle. You ascend to the highest point of the rope and then you descend on the rope, right? And the way you do that is you lay your body literally and you balance your body on this rope and you kind of hook one leg over it. It's almost like you're in jiu-jitsu, like if you're in the guard and you're trying to trap somebody's one arm in. That's kind of like how you're dangling on this rope, and they're in, you know, the rope's high up, it's maybe, I don't know how many meters, 10, 20, 30 meters up in the air.
So high.
It's high up. And I was like, really? I'm like, yeah, guy, you're good. And there's like no net. There's no like mulch. There's no rubber. And I did that shit. And I was like, okay. You know? And they're like, I got down and they're like, nice job. You know? And I think that's what really hooked me and made me really want to work with this population, with the population
so
that I do now.
You climbed it up at an angle?
Climbed up. It was like, it was on a tree, you know. It was just like one of these rope courses out here that you see all over the place, you know.
Just without any nets.
Just no nets. Just no nets. I was a fool. No liability. I ain't signing any paperwork. I was fit to get somebody sued, man.
That wasn't a base, right?
So. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's top secret.
Yeah, no one would have known. It's pretty crazy.
How long did you work for Exos?
So, on and off for, I guess it was like maybe 7 years. Yeah, 7 or 8 years. I did a lot of their workshops. I did that quite a bit, which was basically like travel all around the country, stop at different bases, and teach like 2-week workshops on fundamentals of diet, nutrition, and movement, stretching, soft tissue, foam rolling, all that good stuff, you know?
After 7 years of Exos, what's the main takeaways? What's the big things you learned from that chapter in your career?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. The big takeaways, I mean, you know, the takeaways were a lot stronger earlier on, you know, for me, in terms of like what I got from a system or from an organization, you know, the first time I went there was I think it was 2006 or 2007. I went out to Exos in Arizona And yeah, I picked up like, some good practices, best practices on movement preparation, on acceleration mechanics, and how to teach them in a really straightforward, simple way that was effective, So those are the biggest things that I think that are still permeate what I do today is really that movement preparation, acceleration, deceleration, movement stuff,
One of the things I really took away when we started talking about exercise and so on, they're the first one that basically not only made but also took this whole strength and conditioning thing corporate. That's by far one of their contributions to the industry. They basically made the whole thing into a system that was able to break it down into different aspects and then be able to teach it, whatever, go to Google, go to Facebook, then go to the military and teach people, train people based on a system. If you have 300 coaches, and I'm sure at their peak, what was the most they had? It's quite a lot of coaches to have under you, and to basically put into a system that works.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the universality of a system that can, you can bounce between all these different populations, whether it's like a professional soccer team, a football team, or, you name it. Yeah, those are the big takeaways.
As your phone
Yeah,
going,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
the first time on this podcast.
Oh yeah. Hey man.
when we were 5 minutes into recording, I was like, I didn't tell you to turn your phone off, so I was like, maybe that's the first time that the phone goes off.
Yeah,
But
it's probably, who knows? I ignore that thing all the time, man. If you try to call me, like, my bad, because I'm terrible with it. Yeah, there it goes. Good.
after Exos, you went to England, right?
Yeah.
You were already in England
Well,
partially.
yeah, so Exo, well, still working for Exos at that time, because they were controlling the contracts, all the military contracts that we were working with. So yeah, I was working in North Carolina at a base there, still employed by Exos, and then yeah, I went to the UK also under an Exos contract, working with same kind of group of guys there. So
That you can't talk about.
yeah, but it's cool. I mean, yeah, just yeah, phenomenal experience. Same thing. It's like, what did you learn in college? I don't even remember, but I remember the people that I met. And I think that's the thing that sticks to me more is I think about like the folks that I've interacted with, Dennis Logan and, guys that Adam Ronde, like guys that I'm always like reach back to and that I see what they do and I like aspects of their craft that I tried to emulate, replicate, adopt. And make, to make what I do and how I teach and how I coach or how I improve people better, And yeah, so I don't know if that's necessarily like being really creative or
That's
if
a really
it's
good
just
point.
being if it's being like, a good imitator, But I just try to find the best people and imitate the pieces that I can from them, and then when I get hit with a situation that I know I've seen them be really successful in. I try to, well, what would he think? Well, how would he approach this? What would his group look like if he was talking to this group? How would Brandon get this group of people to be ready to run through this fucking wall right now and like not stop at anything? How would he talk to them? How would he connect with them? Those are the things that like really stick with me more than like any other lessons learned is the
System
interactions.
base. Cool, then you came to Stuttgart.
Yeah, now I'm in
You
Stuttgart.
have made some pretty cool equipment.
Yeah, that's
You
right.
got in touch with VA7,
Yep.
and
Thank you, by the way. Shout
pleasure.
out to Jason, huh? What a guy. Yeah.
The stuff you came up with that they made for you, I really like it. So tell the listeners a bit about.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a so as soon as I got here, I knew that I was gonna need, well, let me backtrack this. I love strength training, but but I really love strength training tools. Like it goes back to that, like the steel pipe and the concrete block. It's like that is what I love. And every time I walk in here, like I walk up to all your bars and I caress every barbell. I'm like, it's just, that's what, long story short, that's what I'm really fired up about, is the craft of the tools. So when I got here, you're the first person I asked. It's like, Wolfgang's going to know, who are the guys making the best equipment out here? And yeah, he gave me their contact, and
he excelled by far.
Yeah, for sure.
And the quality they make it's basically German engineered equipment.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, we can hack any sort of problem, so it's, you know, problem solving. You know, I wanted a kit for guys to be able to travel with that could, you know, be built out into a squat rack. So not anything unlike a couple other companies are making, the Beaver Fits or the, you know, I don't know whoever else, but lots of other folks are making it, but I like to see that idea and then think on ways to improve it. How can you make it better? You know, and those guys are able to do it. If it's like making that equipment more mobile or making it lighter or making it, you know, like putting on some small attachments to improve it. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's been a real pleasure to work with those guys, you know?
So what you made is transportable racks.
Yeah, transportable racks that can move around anywhere. They have a barbell that's collapsible. So a barbell that can like literally fold in half and you can unfold it and train with it. Gosh, what else did they make? I mean, they did some racks for us outside, some storage units as well. Yeah,
I like that container.
Yeah, the container was cool.
Container they made for you.
Yeah, yeah, and again, there are other folks that are making it, but you know, it's nice when you can say like, "Hey, can you add this? Can you subtract this?"
There's pictures on your Instagram, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's your Instagram handle for people that want to look at the container?
Shango Strength, Shango Strength, Shango Strength. If you wanna follow me on Insta, hashtag Get Strong. Yeah, that's me.
Cool.
Yeah.
And there's another thing I wanted to talk about, which I really liked, is you have a project in mind in Ghana.
Yeah.
You want to set the world record for eating the most chicken with peanut sauce and rice.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, Shito as well. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's my dream, is to
own the world record in eating the most chicken 100%. With peanut sauce and rice.
I would love that. I would love that record. That would be... I could die a happy man with that.
I've had a client, and he had a friend, and he was from Ghana, and his parents obviously too.
Yeah.
And his mom would make chicken with peanut sauce and rice 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Like every single day was the same food.
Yeah. Oh,
and
man.
He said every time they went there, they had it, and he loved it.
Still. That's impressive. That's got to be some... That's really good. Man. Yeah, so, but yeah, this dream that I got, man, I want to own this, own a gym in either Ghana or Senegal, but in West Africa. Yeah, open a facility there, doing some strength training, doing some jiu-jitsu, maybe doing some combatives training, some, you know, light tactics training as well.
UFC Performance Center, West Africa.
Yeah, why not? Why not? I think it would work really well.
Conditioning coach.
Yeah, I think there's a lot.
I've been actually talking about this for years now.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent.
One of the places where,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's weird. You know, I remember having a conversation with somebody about this. They'll remain unnamed, but they are a CEO of a large company with a huge international reach, and he asked me what my goals were, and this was. Man, this was probably 12, 13 years ago. And I said, well, I'd love to take this to Africa. And I said, do you think there's any possibility or any opportunities there? And I asked him that, but I know the answer. I know the answer is yes. 100%. And he said, absolutely not. And I thought, you know, and at that moment, I instantly thought less of this person, you know. And I instantly thought like, man, you know, even if, you know, even if there isn't an immediate opportunity, to say there is none to somebody in my position, young, hungry, is sort of foolish, you know? And I thought, that's interesting. You know, people will reveal little bits about shortcomings, especially as leaders, you know? And that's, that's one other thing that's been so interesting about the field that I've been working in, is that I'm surrounded by so many leaders all the time at all different levels. And the rotation of leadership it revolves so much faster than I think it does in most people's lives. You know, most people, like, you work in an office, you have a boss, you have a underboss, maybe you have an underboss. And those folks don't rotate every couple of years, you know, they're there for a while, probably. Right. But I've been in the situation where it's like every 3 years, I see a new boss, I see a new game plan, I see a new style of leadership. And, it's been incredible to see, like, hey, how different people attach to leadership and how they motivate people or how they manage talent is, I think, a better way to think about it. Like, how do people manage the talent that they have, on their teams, you know? How do they encourage people that are in positions that are, you know, technically sort of beneath them, I guess, you know? That to me was an instance of, like, yeah, it's pretty poor management. You didn't have to tell the 22-year-old Manny that his dream is foolish.
No.
You know what I mean?
But it stuck with you.
Huh?
It's been 13, 14 years ago and it stuck with you.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of fueled.
100%. Yeah, it's fueled me, for sure. Yeah, because I know.
Yeah, there's 100% chance. Organized strength and conditioning. But anybody who does not know Senegalese wrestling.
Yeah.
And was it Gambian wrestling?
Mm-hmm.
It's more or less the same, just different countries.
Yeah.
I looked that up.
Impressive. And then even like the culture there, and I've never actually been, but got some very good friends that have been there multiple times, and they talk about like this culture of people being, you know, training daily. You know, there's a long stretch of beach in Dakar, and apparently folks are in the evening time, as soon as the temperatures drop, you can drive up and down this whatever 10-mile strip and see people doing calisthenics and running, and it's like a, you know, communal thing. People are doing that in mass, you know, and that's lovely to be around.
You know what the first calisthenics video I ever saw?
Yeah.
Was the Rough Riders street work.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like New York playground.
Yeah.
Calisthenic training.
Yo, those guys were awesome. The bar stars. They're doing crazy stuff.
I still remember having that as a burned DVD.
Yeah.
And it said Rough Riders street workout. And you know, it's now on YouTube. I checked that out a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And
that was right around that time. Yeah, really impressive stuff they were doing. Yeah, how cool. You know, and now you were talking about going to Venice Beach. It reminded me of being out there too. And I was actually there with Brandon. We're at University of Virginia. We're playing USC, another beautiful school to go visit and to play in the Coliseum. It was amazing. It felt like we were gladiators, you know, coming into that stadium.
How big is that? USC is University of California in LA, right?
Yeah.
How big is the stadium?
Oof, not sure.
Big.
Yeah, it's big, but it's not like Clemson big.
Okay.
Because it's older. It's one of the oldest stadiums in the country, actually. Yeah.
What's the biggest football stadium? It must be over 100,000, right? Somewhere in Texas.
Yeah, I'm sure. Definitely. It would be in Texas. Yeah. Absolutely.
Have you seen the new season of Chef's Table? Barbecue season?
No.
The first episode is on an old woman called Tootsie.
Okay.
And she is the...
I know that name.
The main person who runs the fire at a barbecue place an hour outside of Austin, Texas.
Okay.
And she is a facility manager in a high school during the week. And then on Saturday morning, she wakes up around 1 o'clock and then drives to that barbecue place, and then she basically manages the fire and then she has this, like, it looks like one of these cleaning devices where you clean the floor.
Yeah.
And she uses that to put sauce on the meat.
Okay.
And then she has this big ass platter of meat. They make like brisket, ribs, pulled pork, and then she puts this base sauce with this mop all over the meat, and then she cooks the meat, and then people line up, like there's a huge line, and it's basically, I think it starts at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
And they're open until they sell out.
Amazing.
And they have this the meat is grilling over the barbecue.
Ah man, some good brisket. I actually had brisket on Christmas Day. I went to my friend's house. They were they made some brisket tacos, which is homemade tacos, bro. Yeah, like
out of all barbecue meats, brisket is my favorite. That's delicious. I actually ordered brisket a week ago, and I'm gonna make it at home.
Okay.
I have no smoker.
Yeah.
But I bought liquid smoke. I bought smoked salt.
Okay, that'll do it.
And I bought the barbecue dry rub. So the goal is that I'm gonna vacuum it. I'm gonna put a whole bunch of dry rub on it, plus the smoked salt.
Yeah.
Plus the liquid smoke. And then I'm going to cook it for 72 hours.
Okay.
At 68 degrees.
Yeah.
So the goal is that it has a really nice smoky barbecue flavor.
Yeah.
And completely falls apart.
Yeah.
If that works out, that there's going to be
a
new staple. Brisket is a piece of meat that we barely use in Germany.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Beef breast.
Yeah.
But it's not commonly used here. Not at all.
Yeah.
And if it's cooked that long, so it really gets tender and falls apart. It's out of all barbecue pieces. The last time I was at an actual American barbecue joint was in Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
When I visited Preston the last time.
Yeah.
And went to this barbecue place, and they do like cornbread. And we got so much food. It was a group of us, and we had so much food. I think half was left over because these portions are so huge.
Yeah.
And it was really, really good.
Oh man, I'm actually missing home right now. Like, yeah, I'm usually pretty good about like just being wherever I'm at is where I'm at, and then, but yeah,
that's what I miss. Virginia?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Actually, my sister worked in Alexandria for a year, and so I visited her, and it was a beautiful Alexandria, Virginia.
Oh yeah.
That was.
Yeah, Virginia's a great state. We got everything. We got mountains, we got ocean, beaches,
climate wine. Is very similar to Germany, right?
Yeah. It's pretty similar. It's not in the summer it's definitely more humid. Okay. It's hotter and more humid and for longer. But yeah, very varied climates and definitely like the landscape.
Snow, right?
A little bit. We used to get a lot more. Global warming, you know what I'm saying? Okay. Go figure. Yeah. The bears also, they started migrating. We don't see as many bears. I remember literally like there was a bear that like wandered through my neighborhood when I was like, I don't know, a young kid. But yeah, temperature change.
We spoke about this before the recording, but bears and wolves were natural predators around here in the south of Germany.
Yeah.
But they basically all migrated away towards the north and towards the east because of population density.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see much wildlife around here at all.
We have quite a lot. We have quite a lot. It's almost 1 million boar that get shot every year.
Yeah.
So not that they're around. It's 1 million that gets shot every year. Almost. It's 800 times something. So we have quite a bit of wildlife.
Yeah.
There's deer and boar. There's a lot of them. Certain parts also have red deer.
Okay.
Obviously they don't get as big as in Hungary or in Russia, but still decent size. So there's quite a bit of wildlife we have, just you don't see it unless you wait for it.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I mean, because you got all this like just beautiful scenery around. You know, I walk out my apartment, 5 minutes, I'm surrounded in woods. Don't see any deer. If I was in Virginia, you'll see deer. You'll see deer like running through.
Okay, now stuff like this. Shy here.
Yeah,
like you have to be even if you go hunting, you have to be like super quiet.
Okay, all right, that makes sense. American deer, they're not shy at all. No. Yeah.
Deer, they're super shy.
No scruples.
If you're loud, and you make a lot of noise in a certain area of the forest, a deer will notice. They will not go to this area for quite some time.
Yeah.
So they are like trying to stay away as much as possible.
Yeah.
the majority of it. Boar is not that shy sometimes. It will get goes fairly close. Fox too.
Yeah.
But the deer, this wildlife in general is fairly shy. But then our civilization, the density is so high. If you look at areas like Colorado or Utah,
yeah,
where you have these big stretches of land, but basically there's no civilization, and then you have these elk and these bear and so on.
Yeah,
you need low density of population to have wild game to flourish and to be less shy. Or you go to Russia. I have seen some pictures from hunting trips from Russia, and the wildlife there, it's nuts.
Yeah.
Russia and Turkey, they have wild boar of like 300 kilos.
That's incredible.
You get a big one here, it's like 150 kilos. That's yeah. Like big.
Have you been to Russia before?
No, never been to Russia. Almost went.
I almost got
a job as a strength and conditioning coach for the Russian speed skating national team.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Almost that happened. But then yeah. The guy that was supposed to get head coach didn't get head coach.
Yeah.
And then a few other things. So that was basically right after I worked with the Hungarian national team for 3 years.
Okay.
And right after that, that would almost happen that Russia would have been Moscow every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Would have been quite
really interesting.
Interesting trip.
Yeah. I was going to go to the World Cup. Whatever it was, last year, 2 years ago? 2 years ago? But yeah, didn't work out. I think I missed my shot. I don't know if I'm making it to Russia anytime soon. Trying to go to Africa, man. Yeah, next stop. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You need a visa, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For Ghana, you need a visa.
For Russia?
Oh, for Russia?
Yeah.
Yeah, you must need a visa. Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember.
It's an interesting one. What's the best passport to have in the world right now?
Right now?
So, you can tell us so much. Singapore was at the top of the list for quite some time.
Yeah.
The UAE, United Arab Emirates,
yeah,
was at the top of the list for quite some time too. But what country, what's the best passport to have in the sense of what's the most countries you can go with no visa or visa on arrival?
United Kingdom.
No.
Germany.
Yes.
Get out of here. I should have just guessed Germany first.
We've always been like place two, place three.
Yeah.
But now actually with Corona restrictions,
yeah,
the German passport is by far the best one. As far as travel,
man, let's go Germany. Yeah, not bad.
German works. Actually, I've heard about a guy who became a dad. So, and they actually got the kid in the U.S. Despite being German,
yeah,
they get the kid in the U.S. So the kid now has a U.S. passport. So he has a German and a U.S. passport.
Yeah, that's
which is as far as the combination.
Yeah,
because with the U.S. passport, the Americas are open.
Yeah.
And with a German passport, basically all of Europe and Asia.
Yeah.
So that combination is a pretty pretty amazing one as far as travel.
And it must be in Africa, the best passport must be a Nigerian passport.
Yeah.
I don't know that study. I'm just saying it. I was just going to say biased
opinion. Do you have a Nigerian
one? No, I don't. I don't.
You have an American one?
Yeah, so yeah. Born, this yeah. American one, yeah. Yeah. It would get kind of complicated to have more than one.
Yeah, yeah, I'm few,
sticking with the sticking with the USA for me. Yeah.
There's a few countries where you could basically go almost nowhere without a visa.
Yeah. Interesting. Brexit. What that's going to do as well. Whatever.
See, it's going to be a... For shipping stuff to the UK, it's going to be filling out a lot of taxpayer.
Yeah.
Similar to shipping stuff to Switzerland and so on.
Okay.
But then beyond that, let's see how the UK economy... Because for them, getting certain things from Europe is going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah, and there was no COVID when they decided this.
Yeah.
Man. Wow. Wow.
You worked for 2 years in the UK?
Longer, almost 4 years.
4 years, UK.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I was there heavy.
And now a year.
Just running around London like a fiendo, having a blast. Yeah.
It was a good time?
Oh, it was amazing. It was great. I mean, for one, it was like the group of guys that I worked with there. I I had actually worked with some of them for 4 years prior. So, you know, imagine getting a chance to like coach the same people for like 9 years, you know, it's like not normal, you know? So it was, you know, it's like being with family. So the professional side of things was fantastic. Although, I mean, it was obviously hard at first. You're learning new stuff, new country, how to get things done, et cetera, et cetera. But all in all, this is wonderful, wonderful experience there. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Emmanuel, I'd say wrap this up.
Yeah, man.
Anything else you want to share with the listeners? I'm definitely saying check out your Instagram.
And yeah, check me out. Look
at the equipment you've made and those containers. This is I really like that idea and how it's been put together.
Yeah, man. Yeah, check me out. And again, appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you and hang out and join this long list of great folks you've had to hang out and chat with and be on your podcast. And yeah, you know, I obviously I'm a big fan of what you do, and I've enjoyed getting a chance to work with you and actually have you coach me. I've seen a lot of his success already in the past, whatever, however a couple months it's been. And I couldn't think of
3 months right now, right?
3 months, yeah, 3 months. And I feel fantastic. I see all my improvements. And
you squat up to 600 pounds and your weight down to 160.
Yeah, that's it. That's coming. It's on the way.
Yeah, 4 times body weight squat. Right?
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, man, what a pleasure. And, you know, what sweet serendipity it is that 10 years later we're sitting here and, you know, I've had all these experiences. You had a son. You know, man, life is amazing. It's pretty cool. So, yeah, I can't say enough about how thankful and how glad I am to be here in this moment. And, yeah,
so doing this thing. On,
thanks, man.
Well, actually, it's a very short list of people that have been on the podcast that actually spoke English.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
Only a handful of English guests so far.
Yeah.
So, thank you for being on.
Appreciate you, man. Absolutely.
All the best with your projects.
Thanks,
especially,
man,
the Ghana project. I'm really looking forward to see how that's going to flourish.
Ah, cool. Thanks so much, man.
Emmanuel, thank you.
Thanks, bro.